December 26, 1983, Dallas, Texas. 2-year-old Amber Crum is reported missing after James Britt Monroe, the live-in boyfriend of Amber's mother, Stephanie Hughes, tells police that Amber was abducted from his pickup truck while he was inside a grocery store. Weeks later, Britt is arrested on suspicion of murder after Stephanie implicates him in Amber's death. But after Stephanie recants her original story, Britt is released from custody. A convicted child murderer named David Elliott Penton is eventually looked at as a person of interest in Amber's disappearance, but there is no evidence to implicate him, and no trace of Amber is ever found. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and this week, we're going to be covering a missing children's case which took place nearly 40 years ago, the 1983 disappearance of 2-year-old Amber Crum. That voice you just heard narrating our intro was Jana Getz, the latest winner of our most recent Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest, so thank you very much, Jana. This is a recurring monthly contest which we've been carrying on for over 6 years now, so if you'd like to enter and haven't already done so, I will be providing instructions near the end of this episode. Per tradition, this podcast always spends the month of December covering cases which took place on or around Christmas time, and I remember learning about this one at the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit after reading a series of extensive threads written about 2 years ago by a poster under the username RebelScum320. You're probably familiar with the unsolved abduction and murder of Amber Hagerman, which took place in Arlington, Texas in January of 1996, and led to the launch of the Amber Alert, which was named after her. While I've seen some sources refer to Amber Crum as the quote-unquote other Amber, because she was another young girl who went missing in the Dallas-Fort Worth-Arlington area, but her case is not as well known, and unlike Amber Hagerman, Amber Crum has never been found. The story goes that on the day after Christmas in 1983, James Britt Monroe, the live-in boyfriend of Amber's mother, Stephanie Hughes, took the child with him on a trip to the grocery store and left her inside his pickup truck while he went inside to shop for a few minutes, but after he returned, he discovered that Amber was gone. Now, if you followed enough missing children's cases, you'll know that these situations come across quite suspiciously, and more often than not, it's speculated that the child's parent or guardian was responsible for their disappearance and fabricated a cover story. Well, law enforcement obviously felt the same way in this case, as Britt would soon be arrested on suspicion of Amber's murder, after her mother gave a sworn statement which seemed to indicate that Britt was abusive towards her child and may have caused her death. However, when Stephanie testified at a preliminary hearing, she recanted parts of her original story, and without Amber's body or any other evidence of foul play, the authorities could not indict Britt for murder and had no choice but to release him from custody. The story became even more complicated decades later when David Elliott Penton, a convicted child murderer who was living in Texas during the 1980s, supposedly made some incriminating statements in prison to suggest that he might be responsible for the unsolved disappearances of a number of missing girls, including Amber. So what actually did happen to her? Was she the victim of a stranger abduction, or did her own guardians cover up the truth? Well, at the time of this episode's release, we're less than 1 week shy of the 40th anniversary of when Amber went missing, so we're going to explore all the different angles on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. As our Patreon page currently has over 60 exclusive bonus episodes in our archives, which are not available on our regular feed. I also just wanted to mention that if we manage to reach our goal of 500 Patreon subscribers by the end of 2023, we will provide an additional extra special bonus to all of our patrons in January. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the disappearance of Amber Crumb. Our story begins in Dallas, Texas in 1983, and our central figure is 2-year-old Amber Nicole Crumb. Amber currently lives with her 19-year-old mother, Stephanie Hughes, and Stephanie's 22-year-old live-in boyfriend, James Britt Monroe, who goes by the name Britt. For the past 7 months, they've all been residing together in Britt's house, which is located in the Pleasant Grove area on Dowdy Ferry Road. At the beginning of the year, Stephanie became separated from Amber's 22-year-old father, Larry Crumb, who subsequently moved out of state, and their divorce would be finalized on December the 1st. On the morning of December the 26th, the Dallas Police Department received a phone call in which Amber was reported missing. When they spoke to Britt, he claimed that he had left his house and loaded Amber into his pickup truck before driving 2 blocks to a store called McDonald's Grocery, which was located on Murdoch Road. Britt said that he left Amber alone inside his unlocked truck before he went into the store and spent the next 2 minutes purchasing soft drinks and paper towels, but by the time he returned to the truck, Amber was gone. Since the Dallas PD initially felt that Amber may have wandered off, they organized an extensive ground and helicopter search, but could find no trace of her. Investigators changed their tune when they noticed that the pickup truck's doors were difficult to open, as they found it unlikely that Amber could have exited the truck on her own, and began to suspect that she was the victim of an abduction. Since Stephanie's divorce had been finalized only 3.5 weeks earlier, police looked into the possibility that Amber's father Larry may have kidnapped her, but it was soon established that he was in Carrollton, Kentucky on the day Amber went missing. After he was ruled out as a suspect, Larry took the initiative to travel to Dallas in order to participate in the search effort for his daughter. During the earliest stages of the investigation, police publicly stated that they did not consider Britt or Stephanie to be suspects, but they also wanted them both to take lie detector tests, and there seemed to be delays coordinating a time for this to take place. And while the authorities were exploring the possibility that Amber was abducted by a stranger, there did not seem to be any witnesses to such an event, or any apparent signs of a struggle in Britt's truck. Well, on January the 13th, 1984, 2.5 weeks after Amber vanished, the case would go in a shocking direction when a warrant for probable cause was obtained in order to arrest Britt on suspicion of Amber's murder. He was held in the Dallas County Jail on a $50,000 bond, and 3 days later, Britt was formally charged with murder in the death of a child. At the time, this was only the second case in the history of Dallas where a murder charge had been filed against a suspect without the victim's body being found. Prior to this, Britt already had a history of troubles with the law, as he had previously been arrested and charged with such offenses as possession of illegal drugs, processing methamphetamine, and firing off a gun behind his home within the city limits. Britt first popped up on the radar as a suspect after Stephanie's family hired a prominent Dallas-based private investigator named William Deere to search for Amber. Deere attempted to reconstruct the scene of Amber's disappearance at McDonald's Grocery in order to get a better idea of how a stranger abduction might have taken place, but he noticed that Britt kept giving a number of inconsistent statements, such as the spot where he parked his truck. In addition, there did not appear to be any witnesses from the store who could confirm having seen Amber there at all that morning. Deere also started to explore the possibility that Britt was abusive towards Amber. Some of Stephanie's relatives told Deere that 2 months before the child went missing, Stephanie had told them that Britt would lose his temper around Amber. While they never actually saw Britt strike Amber, they had noticed bruises on various parts of her body, including her back, leg, and ear. When Amber's disappearance received coverage on the local news, they circulated a photograph which had been taken of her opening her presents on Christmas morning. A closer look at the photo seemed to reveal what appeared to be a hand-shaped bruise on Amber's face near her mouth. When Deere questioned Britt about this, he admitted that he had once spanked Amber when she tried to crawl into a clothes dryer, but denied physically striking her or being abusive. Well, after Deere spoke to Stephanie, she moved out of Britt's residence on January the 11th and was re-interviewed by police the following day. Stephanie then proceeded to give a sworn statement about how she and Britt had used illegal drugs on Christmas Day, and during the evening, she overheard Britt yelling at Amber while he was giving her a bath because the child apparently had not swallowed food he'd given her. Britt then placed Amber inside her crib, but Stephanie said that when she checked on her daughter at around 9:30 p.m., Amber was facing the wall, and her eyes were open and not blinking. Stephanie also said that when she kissed Amber, her body felt cold, and even after she covered Amber with a blanket and gave her a doll, she did not see any movement from the child at all. Stephanie claimed that when she woke up at 9:30 a.m. the following morning, she noticed that Amber's blanket, sheets, nightgown, and pillowcase were missing. Britt then told her that he had washed all these items, which she found very unusual, since Britt had never done laundry during the entire time they had lived together. Since Stephanie could not confirm having seen Amber herself that morning, she suspected that the child had been dead when she saw her in the crib on Christmas night, and Britt subsequently disposed of her body and fabricated a cover story about taking Amber to the store in his pickup truck. Stephanie's story is what compelled investigators to obtain a warrant to arrest Britt the following day. A search of Britt's house failed to turn up any evidence that foul play had taken place, but police claimed that when they gave Britt a polygraph, he attempted to control the results by altering his breathing pattern, so the test was rendered invalid. 5 days after Britt's arrest, a preliminary hearing was held in Dallas County District Court. When Stephanie took the stand to testify, she surprised everyone by recanting her original statement, claiming that she had been pressured by the police. Stephanie did acknowledge that parts of her story were true, such as her and Britt taking drugs on Christmas Day, but she did not believe he was under the influence. She also confirmed that she heard Britt yelling at Amber in the bathroom during the evening, and that he had put many of Amber's personal items in the laundry the following morning. However, she now denied having seen what appeared to be Amber's dead body in her crib that night, and expressed her belief that the child was still alive somewhere. In spite of Stephanie's recantation, the prosecution would still attempt to poke holes in Britt's story that Amber had been abducted from his parked pickup truck. Charlie Morgan, a customer who had frequented McDonald's grocery on the morning of December the 26th, testified that he arrived in the parking lot while Britt was inside the store, but was certain he did not see Amber inside the truck. There were still no independent eyewitnesses who could confirm having seen Amber near the store that morning, or any outside parties approaching the truck to abduct her. The preliminary hearing would last 2 days, and Britt's defense attorneys argued that the prosecution did not have enough evidence to prove that Amber was even dead, let alone that Britt killed her. The district judge seemed to agree, so on January the 20th, 1 week after Britt's arrest, he ruled that the prosecutors had not shown probable cause to keep Britt in jail and ordered him released due to insufficient evidence. However, he said that Britt could be arrested again if new evidence surfaced, and that the murder charge would remain pending against him until the Dallas County District Attorney's Office presented their case to a grand jury. The grand jury proceedings would be delayed for several weeks, so that police could attempt to find more evidence against Britt. But while this was going on, Britt's defense team told the press that they had heard from a friend and co-worker of his who had spoken to Britt over the phone while he was at his house on the morning of December the 26th. This person was certain that they heard Amber talking in the background, which, if true, would completely negate Stephanie's story about Amber being dead in her crib on Christmas night. The grand jury proceedings would finally take place, and on March the 30th, it was announced that they had declined to indict Britt for murder, so the charge against him was formally dropped. While Britt maintained his innocence, investigators continued to direct their suspicion towards him, maintaining that he made a number of inconsistent statements about the events leading up to Amber's disappearance and did not disclose everything he knew. Even though Stephanie had recanted her original story and still publicly expressed her belief that Amber was alive, she did not reconcile her relationship with Britt and permanently moved out of his house to live with relatives. William Deere came up with the idea to place Stephanie under hypnosis to see if she could provide an accurate recollection of events she may have witnessed at Britt's residence on Christmas night. When the hypnosis took place, Stephanie said that she had a vision of Amber following Britt into the bathroom before she heard the sound of the girl screaming a few seconds later. Stephanie then said that when she went into the bathroom, she saw Britt shaking Amber as he said that the child had not finished her dinner and had gotten something stuck in her mouth, so he was trying to get it out. However, this is where Stephanie's vision apparently cut off, and she said she could not recall anything happening after the incident in the bathroom, leading to speculation that she may have been suppressing her memory of something else she witnessed. Stephanie eventually relocated to Indiana while Brett sold his house and moved in with a new girlfriend. Ironically, she was also named Stephanie and happened to have a 2-year-old daughter of her own, but the new relationship eventually ended. Britt refused to speak with the media or the police and had his attorney make a statement on his behalf that he hoped Amber would be found safe. Well, the case would go in a new direction in August of 1986, when it was announced that a girl named Lisa Jensen had been abandoned at the Holiday RV Park in Scotts Valley, California. Lisa had spent the past several months living there with her father, Gordon Jensen, before he left her with another couple at the park and took off. The couple always had their suspicions that Gordon Jensen abused the girl and that she may not have actually been his daughter. Since the authorities believed that Lisa may have been abducted, they circulated photos of her on television in hopes that someone would recognize her. They soon received a tip from a viewer who had recently seen a photograph of Amber Crumb that was being circulated by the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and this viewer became convinced that Lisa was her. Indeed, Lisa resembled Amber and appeared to be what Amber's approximate age would have been at that time. Lisa also believed that her birthday was September the 22nd, 1981, which was only 3 days off from Amber's birth date since she had been born on September the 25th of that year. But in the end, a fingerprint check ruled out the possibility that Lisa was Amber. However, 3 decades later, Lisa finally learned her true identity, and it turned out she was connected to another prominent cold case, but I'll talk more about that later on in this episode. Anyway, the investigation would remain at a standstill until 2007, when it was announced that a 49-year-old convicted murderer named David Elliott Penton was now considered to be a person of interest in Amber's case, as well as the unsolved disappearances of 2 other girls which took place in Texas. In November of 1984, Penton was a soldier who was stationed at the U.S. Army post Fort Hood in Killeen when he was arrested for the death of his 2-month-old infant son, Michael. Penton claimed that his son would not stop crying, so he violently shook the boy and wound up killing him. He decided to plead guilty to manslaughter and received a 5-year prison sentence, but was allowed to remain free on bond to appeal his case. However, Penton used this opportunity to go on the run as a wanted fugitive, and he would be finally tracked down in Columbus, Ohio in August of 1988. But it turned out that on March the 31st of that year, a 9-year-old girl named Nydra Ross went missing from her aunt's home in Columbus, and she was last seen talking to Penton, a family friend who had been visiting at that time. On September the 15th, Nydra's remains were found in a dry creek bed, and it turned out she had been strangled to death. After spending 1.5 years building a case against Penton, investigators charged him with kidnapping and aggravated murder in May of 1990. He was subsequently found guilty of Nydra's death at his trial just under 1 year later and received a sentence of life imprisonment. Well, over the course of the next decade, investigators would start looking at Penton as a suspect in a number of unsolved cold cases which took place in Texas during the mid-1980s, and in June of 2003, he was indicted for capital murder for killing 3 more girls. The victims in question were 5-year-old Christy Lynn Meeks, who was abducted and murdered in Mesquite in January of 1985, 10-year-old Christy Diane Proctor, who was abducted and murdered from Dallas in February of 1986, and 4-year-old Roxanne Hope Reyes, who was abducted and murdered in Garland in November of 1987. Like Nydra Ross, all 3 victims were sexually assaulted before they were strangled to death. In order to avoid the death penalty, Penton agreed to a plea deal in which he would plead guilty to all 3 crimes and receive 3 additional sentences of life imprisonment. Penton is currently incarcerated at the Toledo Correctional Institution for Nidra Ross's murder and is eligible for parole in 2027, but on the off chance he does receive it, he will then be transferred to a prison in Texas to continue serving his sentences for the other murders. While Penton was officially linked to 5 murders, including the death of his infant son, the authorities have always suspected that he was responsible for additional crimes. In fact, Penton has reportedly told other prison inmates that he has killed at least 50 children. Well, in March of 2007, investigators announced that they considered Penton to be a person of interest in the unsolved disappearances of 3 girls which occurred in Texas during the 1980s, and one of them was Amber Crum. The other 2 victims were 11-year-old Angelica Maria Gandara, who vanished while walking home from her grandmother's residence in Temple on July 14, 1985, and was last seen inside a 1977 Chevrolet pickup truck. The second victim was 9-year-old Ara Denise Johnson, an African-American girl who went by the nickname Nisi, and vanished from the bedroom of her family's mobile home in Big Sandy sometime during the early morning hours of April 2, 1986. Penn had allegedly made incriminating statements about Nisi's case to a cellmate, which prompted law enforcement to launch a new investigation, and while details are vague, he may have also said incriminating things about Amber and Angelica's cases as well. Investigators also said that Penn was being looked at as a person of interest in the disappearance of 6-year-old Shannon Sherrill, who vanished from a trailer park in Thorntown, Indiana on October 5, 1986. However, no conclusive evidence has ever been found to link Penton to any of these additional crimes. One more thing worth mentioning about Amber's case is that in October of 2020, the Unsolved Mysteries reboot on Netflix released an episode titled Stolen Kids, which covered the 1989 disappearances of infants Christopher Dansby and Shane Walker, who both vanished from the same playground in Harlem just under 3 months from each other. The end of the episode featured a roll call of photographs of other missing children who were 2 years old or younger, and one of them was Amber Crum. However, after 40 years, there's still no conclusive answers about what happened to her. So I guess you could say the trail went cold. So before I talk any more about Amber Crum's disappearance, I need to make mention of a true crime YouTube series called True Crime Web, which has released a series of episodes about her case this past year. In fact, they even helped organize a search of a property where the man believed to be the prime suspect, James Britt Monroe, had once lived. While some bones were found underneath the house on the property, none of them turned out to be human, and thus far, no evidence has ever been turned up in relation to Amber's case. As you might recall, Amber's father, Larry Crum, had gotten divorced from her mother, Stephanie Hughes, and was in Kentucky at the time Amber went missing. Larry participated in this aforementioned search and has done some interviews on this YouTube channel as he is making an active effort to try and find out what happened to his daughter. By contrast, Stephanie and her former boyfriend, Britt Monroe, have pretty much kept out of the spotlight since the murder charge against Britt was dropped in 1984, and have not been very proactive with searching for Amber. Like I mentioned in the intro, there seem to be a number of missing children's cases where the child just happened to disappear when their parent or guardian left them alone for a few minutes inside a parked vehicle at a public place. While I'm sure there are a few documented cases in which a child has been abducted under these circumstances, more often than not, this whole scenario comes across as a fabricated cover story, which the parent or guardian has dreamed up in order to hide their own culpability. Of course, since the world was a much different place back then, I guess it might not have seemed so unusual to leave a 2-year-old girl unattended inside a parked truck back in 1983. If you look at the original news coverage of Amber Crum's disappearance, it does appear that police were initially willing to take Britt Monroe at his word and believe that Amber might have wandered off or been abducted from his truck by a stranger, but once they started hearing allegations about Britt being physically abusive towards the child, he became the focus of the investigation. While there was not enough evidence at that time to indict Britt with murder, it seems like he remained the primary suspect for over two decades until David Elliott Penn's possible involvement entered the equation. But while Penn is undoubtedly a monster who's abducted and killed a number of young girls in Texas during the 1980s, I'm not sure there's much in the way of actual evidence linking him to Amber's case, and there are far more reasons to be suspicious of Britt and Stephanie. But before we talk any more about Amber's case, I just want to take a few moments to discuss Lisa Jensen, the abandoned girl who was found in California in 1986, and was initially suspected to be Amber until a fingerprint check ruled that out. Regardless, the authorities still believe that Lisa may have been an abducted child, but after she was adopted, she grew up and went on to have a normal life, and got married and had three children of her own. But she still wanted to find out her true identity, and in 2016, DNA testing in genetic genealogy would reveal that her real name was actually Dawn Bowden, and her biological mother, Denise Bowden, had gone missing from Goffstown, New Hampshire in November of 1981, when Dawn was only 6 months old. At the time, Denise Bowden was involved in a relationship with a man named Bob Evans, who was not Dawn's biological father, and was likely responsible for Denise's disappearance. Evans proceeded to keep Dawn in his custody, and over the next few years, they lived under a couple of different aliases, including Gordon and Lisa Jensen, before he abandoned the child in 1986. It would later turn out that Bob Evans' real name was Terry Peter Rasmussen, and he would later go to prison for the unrelated murder of a woman named Eunsoon Jun before he died in December of 2010. Now, the revelation with Lisa slash Dawn's DNA testing would help blow the lid off another famous cold case. You might be familiar with the Bear Brook murders, where two 55-gallon drums containing the skeletal remains of a woman and three children were discovered buried in Bear Brook State Park in Allentown, New Hampshire in November of 1985. It was not until 2019 when DNA testing identified the woman as 24-year-old Marlise Elizabeth Honeychurch and two of the children as her daughters, 7-year-old Marie Elizabeth Vaughn and 11-month-old Sarah Lynn McWaters. Oddly, the DNA testing would reveal that the third child had no genetic connection to the other three victims, and she has still not been positively identified. However, the testing has shown that she was Terry Rasmussen's biological child, though investigators have yet to figure out the identity of her mother. This entire saga is far too complicated to go into here, so if you want to learn more information, I'd recommend listening to the long-form podcast Bear Brook. But long story short, throughout the course of his life, Terry Rasmussen was responsible for murdering several people while living under multiple identities, and he earned the nickname the Chameleon Killer. Given the circumstances, Lisa Jensen slash Dawn Bowden is lucky that she did not become one of his victims as well, and if she had not submitted her DNA for genealogical testing, I do not believe the authorities ever would have uncovered the truth about the Bear Brook murders. So yeah, while this whole side story ultimately had nothing to do with Amber Crumb's case, it wound up leading to the opening of an entirely different rabbit hole. But now let's get back to Amber's disappearance. Obviously, the most prevalent theory is that Britt Monroe caused Amber's death on Christmas night, and after disposing of her body and covering his tracks, he concocted his truck abduction cover story the following morning. During the earliest stages of the investigation, law enforcement told the press that they did not consider Britt or Stephanie to be suspects, but I think the major turning point occurred when Stephanie's family hired private investigator William Deere to search for Amber. Deere was the one who uncovered the allegations that Britt was abusing Amber, and when he took his findings to police, that's when Stephanie shared her sworn statement about seeing Amber dead inside her crib, and this led to Britt being arrested on suspicion of murder. Now, if the name William Deere sounds familiar, that's because he is one of the most prominent private investigators in the United States, and since he has worked on a number of high-profile cases and published some books, he even has his own Wikipedia page. However, Deere is a fairly controversial figure, as he has written at least two books, which push forward the theory that O.J. Simpson did not murder Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman because O.J.'s son, Jason Simpson, was the real killer. I also briefly talked about Deere in the episode I released last year about the 1996 murder of Leon Laurelis, and let's just say that Leon's family was not too happy with the services he provided. But from what I can tell, Larry Crum, and a number of other people associated with this case, were quite happy with how Deer handled the investigation into Amber's disappearance. In fact, the Dallas Police Department has claimed that they have lost or misplaced their file for the case, so Deer's original investigative files have proven to be the most valuable resource all these years later. It's important to remember that Deer was originally hired by Stephanie's family, so obviously, I don't think they expected him to implicate Stephanie or Britt in Amber's disappearance, and Deer simply went where the evidence took him. In other words, I don't think Deer would set out to intentionally railroad people connected to the people who hired him. This whole situation is actually very reminiscent of the 1987 disappearance of 4-year-old Marlena Childress, which I covered on episode number 90 of this podcast. That case also involved the family of a missing child's mother hiring a private investigator who wound up going to the police after hearing the mother make a confession about causing the child's death. The key difference here is that it does not sound like Stephanie admitted to personally being responsible for Amber's death, but much like the situation with Marlena Childress's mother, the case fell apart when Stephanie recanted her original story. Now, we've seen countless cases in which people have made false confessions after being pressured by the police, which is why Stephanie claims she made up the story about seeing Amber's dead body inside her crib. But what's unusual is that Stephanie only seemed to recant this specific part of her story rather than the whole thing. She still stuck to some details which did not exactly paint her or Britt in a flattering light, such as them both using drugs on Christmas Day, her hearing Brett yelling at Amber inside the bathroom, and Britt washing Amber's nightgown and bedding accessories, even though it was very uncharacteristic of him to do laundry. While those details alone are enough to make Britt look suspicious, one of the main reasons the murder case against him fell apart is that when Stephanie testified during the preliminary hearing, she expressed her belief that Amber was still alive. An unnamed relative of Stephanie's would later tell the press, quote, "She desperately wants Amber to be alive, but knows in her heart she's dead. She's just a child herself. She doesn't understand," end quote. Given the circumstances, you can understand why a grand jury decided not to indict Britt for murder, particularly since there was no physical evidence to prove that Amber was dead, and taking someone to trial without a body was extraordinarily rare back then. But I think it speaks volumes that when Britt was released from jail, his relationship with Stephanie immediately came to an end, and she moved in with relatives. Even if Stephanie did not personally witness Amber's death, and could not be 100% certain that Britt killed her, I'm sure she probably still saw him inflict physical abuse upon her daughter. One of the most haunting aspects of this case is the photograph of Amber which was circulated by the media back then, and showed her opening a present on Christmas morning, the day before she went missing. Even though Amber was smiling and appeared to look happy, some of her relatives were convinced that she was sporting a hand-shaped bruise near her mouth. I've looked at this photo, and while it appears like there's something on Amber's face, the quality of the image is not clear enough for me to say with any certainty that it's a bruise. However, we have so many witnesses who claim to have seen other bruises on Amber, as well as Britt sporting a hot temper around her, so I have to believe that he did strike the child on numerous occasions. But did Britt take things too far and cause her death? Well, before we examine this angle, let's look at Britt's story of how Amber went missing. It goes without saying that most people do not believe she was abducted from Britt's pickup truck while it was parked outside McDonald's grocery on the morning of December the 26th. One issue is that there doesn't seem to be any logical reason for Britt to have taken her there to begin with, as it was only 2 blocks from his house, and it was just a quick trip to buy soda and paper towels. It would be one thing if Britt needed to watch the child, but he claimed that he arrived at the store at around 9:45 a.m., and during her statement to police, Stephanie said that she woke up at 9:30. I can understand Britt bringing Amber along with him if Stephanie was still sleeping and he didn't want to wake her up, but he easily could have left Amber behind. Another big hole in Britt's story is that during the last 2 weeks of December in 1983, the Dallas-Fort Worth area was hit with a major Arctic cold snap, which caused the area to experience its coldest winter in history at that point, and temperatures were still well below zero on the morning of the 26th. These were definitely not ideal conditions to bring a child on a trip to the store and leave her sitting alone in a truck for no reason. And most importantly, These are definitely not the type of conditions where you'd expect a random predator to be hanging around outside, just waiting for the opportunity to abduct a child from a parked vehicle. Also, I've watched the contemporary news coverage of Amber's disappearance, which featured footage of the police gathered outside McDonald's grocery, and this is a pretty small store in a fairly rural area with only a limited amount of parking spaces. I think it would just be the most rotten luck imaginable if a predator just happened to be there that morning and managed to abduct Amber from the truck and flee the scene without anyone seeing anything. I find it telling that Britt's original story was that he was inside the store 2 minutes before he came out and discovered Amber was missing, but as time went on, he changed his story and said that he may have been in there as long as 5 minutes, as if he got the sense that no one believed Amber could have been abducted in such a narrow window of time. I know that police discounted the idea of Amber leaving the truck and wandering off on her own because the door was too difficult for a 2-year-old to open, but I don't think she would have been able to make it very far anyway without being noticed. And of course, there were no other witnesses from the store who could confirm having seen Amber at all, and one customer, Charlie Morgan, said that he arrived there almost immediately after Britt went inside and was certain that he saw no one else sitting inside the pickup truck. When you look at the evidence, a stranger abduction really does not seem like a believable scenario, but since David Elliott Penton was later named as a person of interest, let's play devil's advocate and explore the possibility that he could have been responsible. I have to admit that I had never heard of Penton before I started researching this episode. Even though The Trail Went Cold is a victim-centered podcast, sometimes researching these cases will cause me to learn about criminals who may not be all that well known, but are truly vile human beings, and David Elliott Penton seems to be one of the worst of the worst. We know that he abducted and murdered at least 4 girls and killed his own 2-month-old son, but it would not surprise anyone if Penton has harmed additional victims. And perhaps not surprisingly, he has not taken much responsibility for his actions. For years, Penton refused to speak to the media, but finally agreed to do an interview with the Tyler Courier-Times-Telegraph in March of 2007. Believe it or not, he denied being responsible for the murders of Christy Lynn Meeks, Christy Diane Proctor, and Roxanne Hope Reyes, claiming that he only agreed to plead guilty to these crimes so that he wouldn't be extradited to Texas and receive the death penalty. Penton denied ever having abducted, raped, or murdered any girls, and when asked about the murder of Nydra Ross, he simply replied, quote, "I'm not going to comment on that." So yeah, if by chance, Penton was responsible for Amber Crumb's disappearance, I'm not going to hold my breath that he'll admit to it. I have no idea if he was involved in the disappearances of any other girls, such as Angelica Gandara, Niecy Johnson, or Shannon Cheryl, but the main reason he became a person of interest in those cases is because he supposedly made some incriminating statements about them to some cellmates in prison. However, we don't have any specific details about what he might have said, particularly when it comes to Amber's case, and as I'm sure you're well aware, you should always be very skeptical about information which is provided by jailhouse informants. Out of all the crimes Penton has been linked to, or is suspected of being responsible for, Amber's disappearance is the only one which took place before he was charged with the death of his infant son Michael in November of 1984. Prior to that incident, Penton had been stationed at Fort Hood in Killeen, which is located over 150 miles southwest of Dallas. While I couldn't tell you Penton's exact whereabouts on December the 26th, 1983, would he really have been compelled to travel that distance just to abduct and murder a random child, particularly when the area was suffering through a major cold snap? Even if he was, why go to that remote grocery store rather than a busier area in the middle of the city where there would be more opportunities to snatch a victim? How would Penton, or anyone for that matter, have predicted that a child would show up at McDonald's grocery that particular morning and be left alone in a vulnerable position? This crime also doesn't seem to fit Penton's MO, as he abducted his known victims while they were playing outside their home or walking alone down the street, rather than abducting them from a parked vehicle. Unless there is some compelling evidence linking Penton to this case which we don't know about, I'm inclined to think that he is nothing more than a red herring. Overall, it really does seem obvious that Britt's account of Amber disappearing from the truck is just a cover story, but then what actually did happen to her? Even though the primary theory is that Amber died sometime on Christmas night, the big complication is the coworker who claimed he spoke to Britt on the phone on the morning of the 26th and heard Amber speaking in the background. If this caller's story is accurate, then this would prove that Amber was still alive that morning, but how credible are they? We don't have any details about the coworker, and while William Deere brought up the issue that this person was a friend of Britt's, how many of us would willingly lie and cover for a friend who was suspected of killing a child? I'd like to know the exact time this phone call took place. If it occurred very early in the morning, a couple of hours before Britt went to the store and reported Amber missing at 9:45, then there still could have been enough time for something to happen to Amber and Britt to dispose of her body. But if the call happened at, say, 9 o'clock or 9:15 a.m., then this scenario was far less likely. Since we have reports of Britt abusing Amber, you'd have to assume that he was also physically abusive towards Stephanie, though that's never been made clear. If Stephanie's original story was true, and she found Amber's dead body in her crib on Christmas night, you might be wondering why she simply decided to go back to bed without doing anything about it. However, if Stephanie was trapped in an abusive relationship and was fearful of Britt, then her actions make more sense, and she may have only felt comfortable opening up about this to William Deere after he ensured her safety. But if that's the case, then why did Stephanie change her story during the preliminary hearing? Wouldn't it be a more ideal situation if the man who was abusing you and your daughter remained in jail and wound up going to prison for murder? Stephanie's actions tell me that even if she was not personally responsible for Amber's disappearance, she still had some culpability and her own personal reasons for not coming clean and sharing the full truth about everything she knew. As an alternate scenario, what if Amber died as the result of neglect and irresponsible parenting rather than physical abuse? As you recall, the details about Stephanie's original story, which she did not recant, were her and Britt both using drugs on Christmas Day, and Britt yelling at Amber inside the bathroom because the child still had some food in her mouth, which she had not yet swallowed. When Stephanie underwent hypnosis, this part of the story seemed to expand and involved her going inside the bathroom and witnessing Britt attempt to get something stuck out of Amber's mouth. Since Stephanie said that her vision always came to an abrupt end at this point, there's been speculation that she may have repressed her memory of what happened next. Well, if you search online discussions about this case, you'll find a very intriguing theory, and I've seen Larry Crumb bring this one up in interviews. What if Amber may have died after accidentally ingesting some drugs which were lying around the house? Remember, Britt had been arrested a few months earlier for processing methamphetamine, so if he and Stephanie were using meth on Christmas night and had left some in the bathroom, perhaps Amber went in there and thought it was candy or something and put it in her mouth. When Britt found out, he then went ballistic and attempted to get her to regurgitate the drugs, but was unsuccessful. Even if Amber did not die right away, Britt and Stephanie may not have decided to seek medical attention and just placed her inside her crib, where she passed away during the night. If she had a negative reaction and vomited or something, this could explain Stephanie's story about Britt laundering Amber's nightgown and all her bedding accessories. After cleaning up the mess and disposing of Amber's body, Britt then proceeded to drive to McDonald's grocery and fabricated an abduction story. It's unclear how much Stephanie personally witnessed, as she may have legitimately been sleeping during the entire time period when Britt covered the whole thing up, and was telling the truth when she said she woke up at 9:30. It's possible she may have no idea where Amber's body is, and like a relative told the press, has kept up the delusion about believing her daughter is still alive in order to avoid dealing with the responsibility of the situation. But regardless of her actual involvement, Stephanie did cause the case against Britt to fall apart when she recanted her story, and that's why the investigation has been at a standstill ever since. From what I've heard, even though they went their separate ways, Stephanie and Britt are still alive today, but unlike Amber's father, Larry, they have made no attempts to spread awareness about Amber's disappearance or try to find out what happened to her. So this tells me that they're well aware that no stranger abduction took place, and unfortunately, this poor girl's disappearance has remained unsolved for 40 years. Thankfully, there still appears to be an active effort to find Amber, so if you happen to have any information about her disappearance, please contact the Dallas Police Department at 214-670-4426. That's 214-670-4426. Anyway, another special thanks to listener Janet Getz for narrating the opening of this episode. We've been carrying on our monthly listener voiceover contest for over 6 years now, and if you've already entered the contest, you are automatically eligible for our next random drawing, so you don't have to do anything. But if you'd like to enter and haven't already done so, all you have to do is send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see featured on this podcast. So once again, send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 5 years, our Patreon page has released dozens of exclusive bonus episodes, which are all currently available in our archives for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3. This past month, I released an episode about the disappearances of two men named Mel Wilson and Richard Lepsey, as their respective families have explored the possibility that one of these men may have gone on to become the infamous unidentified hijacker known only as D.B. Cooper. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss the 1990 disappearance of three men who vanished after the sinking of a fishing boat called the Casey Nicole. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and we now have over 50 of these commentary tracks in our archives. I'd also like to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Jennifer L., Daniel S., Gina D., Emily P., Kathleen W., Alex R., Amber M., Shelley, Ruth, Alexis M., and John G. Thank you all so much for your support. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit, which actually has a number of interesting discussion threads about today's featured case. I need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composed the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Anyway, this concludes our final holiday-themed episode, which is technically the last time this year we'll be covering an unsolved cold case. However, it is not the very last episode of 2023, as next week, we are going to close the year off with a special Trail Went Cold update episode about all the cases our podcast has profiled which have been solved this year or had some major developments. So have yourselves a great week and a very safe and happy holiday season, and join us again next Wednesday for our special update episode of The Trail Went Cold.